KPCW News time is now 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. Let's find out what we got in store for our weather this weekend. On the phone, I've got Nate Larson with ABC4. Good morning, Nate.
Morning, Park City. Morning, Wasatch back. Yeah, we've got a cloudy start to the day for the most part. We are going to continue to see partly to mostly cloudy skies across the Wasatch back today. Left moisture, we had a little bit of rain yesterday. Nice to see a couple tenths of an inch in Park City on the rain gauge. 62 for the high today. There's still a small threat of an isolated storm later this afternoon and evening as moisture still streams up south to north. Temperatures drop to 39 tonight into tomorrow. We're going to start off nice and sunny for Saturday. 64 for the high tomorrow. Tomorrow, the clear skies are ahead of a storm system moving in over the weekend. We've got rain and snow showers pushing in on Sunday, a cold front dropping highs to low 50s in Park City. Overnight lows will be in the upper 30s. We'll continue to see active weather from Sunday afternoon into Monday with rain and snow continuing. Temperatures just 47 for the high. So enjoy kind of the dry start to your weekend. It is going to be a little bit blustery outside. Strongest winds will be in the southern half of the state, though. As we get into Tuesday, Wednesday, we'll continue to see partly cloudy skies, less of a threat of any showers, though. Tuesday, another weak storm clips us Wednesday, so progressive pattern next week, keeping the chance of rain in the mix on Wednesday, highs in the mid-50s, back to 60 on Thursday, partly cloudy, might see a stray shower or two as well. For Heber, a high of 70 today, partly cloudy skies, sunny on Saturday, low 70s, Sunday, the storm moves in. Be in the upper 50s. We'll drop to the mid-50s on Monday. Plan on primarily rain showers for the Heber Valley, but a bit of a wintry mix possible on Monday with some of the coldest air moving in. Could drop to just 33 Monday morning for the overnight low. We'll see partly cloudy skies on Tuesday, freezing for temperatures Tuesday morning, rebounding to 64 for the high, and then we'll be in the mid to low 60s through midweek with, again, a chance of showers on Wednesday, less of a threat on Thursday.
Sounds like a real spring week, Nate.
It's going to be fun. Yeah.
It will be. All right. Well, listen, thanks and have a good weekend.
You too.
You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Coming up, I'll be speaking with Lana McNaughton and Gina Tuttle of the Wasatch County Health Department. We're going to be talking about measles and their upcoming drug take-back event. Then Councilwoman Tana Tolle will be by to give us a recap of last night's Park City Council meeting. And we'll finish an hour with an interview I recorded yesterday with newly elected Summit County GOP Chairman Ari Ioannidis. Stay tuned. A luxury home builder who needs access to his Wasatch County development via an unpaved Summit County road says he's trying to please everybody. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that residents are fed up with the increase in construction traffic.
Wednesday, Wakara developer Rich Wolper gave a history of the past year of negotiations between the business community and local governments regarding West 200 South. It's commonly referred to as the Gun Club Road, and it leads from Camas to Wasatch County east of the Jordanell Reservoir. That makes it the back door to Toohey and the only entrance to Wakara. Both luxury gated communities have been under construction as of late. Wolper says his development doesn't generate nearly the amount of construction traffic Toohey has.
So if you were at that road, probably, I don't know, 6 months ago, last summer, maybe 8 months ago, it was horrible, and then it just stopped. When they finished their phase, it stopped.
So he says Toohey's done, except for homes individuals decide to build. But in response to resident concerns about dust and safety, speeds have topped 90 miles an hour on the road, Summit County has considered closing West 200 South to all traffic. Wolper alerted the county to his development, which would be marooned, and that set off a series of private meetings to work something out. He says he met with the mayor of Camas, who told him to find an alternate access. So Wolper went to three property owners north of him to explore possible options. All were open to a road, but with some conditions. One person wanted Wolper to build a structure for him because he'd need to move his sheep. Another would let Wolper build a new road if he also transferred the right to develop a few homes to him. The third property owner thought it was okay, but warned Wolper the road may be impassable in the winter. Summit County civil attorney says that whole area is illegally subdivided, throwing a wrench in Wolper's verbal agreements. The developer says he worked out a deal for 2 years of construction access, which is what would be needed for him to finish both phases of Wakara with the three property owners. After that, any individual homes would need to still use the Gun Club Road to build. The county made a preliminary offer that Wakara pave that whole road, pay to maintain it, and never use it for construction traffic. But there isn't unanimity among county officials about whether that's a good deal for Summit County residents. Wolper says he couldn't accept it because he didn't have a permanent construction traffic solution.
What I'm trying to do is, please everybody and, save my project. So I've offered an alternate route. It didn't work. We got an offer from you guys that had just problems that we couldn't overcome.
Gun Club Road resident Jeremy Bristol acknowledged the situation and pickle Waqar is in, since the development can't use Tuhay's private road to the north and butts up against the Jordanelle to the west and south. But he says residents' priority is that Waqar find another access point.
So construction traffic might go away, but residential traffic will not. Speeds are a massive issue.
He floated the idea that the county build a new road through the Ure Ranch, which is in the process of buying for open space. Councilmember Chris Robinson says that's unlikely to work.
Number one, we don't own it yet. The Ures still own it. Until we close on the whole property, it's not ours to speak for. Number two, Jessica Kirby has secured funding from various sources to conserve that property, that we believe if we run a road up through the middle of it, we're going to lose its millions of dollars.
And Waqar and Tuhay residents are still likely to drive the unpaved road regardless, Robinson says. The alternate road would pass through the proposed town of West Hills, too.
Right now, Summit County is acting as the land use authority and highway authority for this piece of real estate, which could change if there were, by some event, a municipality created there. So be careful what you wish for.
Council Chair Tanya Hansen says the county is not seeking a short-term solution, so officials will take more time to deliberate and talk with stakeholders. Another discussion hasn't been scheduled yet, but any action the county council takes as the highway authority must be done in a public meeting. Summit County's a financial supporter of KPCW. I'm Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
So joining me now by phone, we've got Laura Lanham-McNaughton and Gina Tuttle of the Wasatch County Health Department. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks, guys, for joining me this morning. I want to talk about measles, but first, can we share a little bit about why are we seeing cases of measles in 2025?
Well, we're looking at families who've decided not to immunize their children with the MMR vaccine, and we're seeing pockets, of course, in Texas where there's just a low vaccination rate there.
And are we seeing it in other parts of the country as well? Do you have a sense of how many cases we're seeing and what the growth curve looks like?
So we have a rate of 800 that have been diagnosed with measles. But we really believe there's more out there. There's so many more who just get the measles, stay at home, and recover. And so we feel like that's a false number. But it's been rising quite steadily.
And I know you mentioned Texas, but my understanding is that there have been actually identified cases in a number of other states as well. Is that right?
That's true. There's, from my last report, there's 24 states. I think Montana was the last one.
And any in Utah?
Not so far.
No, zero.
So far, so good. You mentioned that there's a strong correlation between the incidence of vaccination and the incidence of disease. Are any of the cases that we've seen reported, have any of them been from non-vaccinated children or adults?
Well, I think a majority of the people who are contacting measles have not been vaccinated. And when you receive the vaccine, you get a very high coverage rate once you receive the vaccine. So that's what we're seeing. Most of the people who are getting measles have not been fully vaccinated.
And bringing it into focus here in Wasatch County, you mentioned that some of the areas in Texas where we're seeing a high incidence of measles, a relatively high incidence, are areas where there is a low incidence of vaccinations. What's Wasatch County look like in terms of, to the extent we know, in terms of the incidence of vaccination among our population?
So currently, I looked at the exemption rates for our county just for MMR, and that's 11.1%. Pre-COVID, we were 4.5%. We've had a 7.6 increase in exemption rates in our community. And it even goes on to look at the different schools, and I look basically at our kindergarten rates for MMR. And so we look across the schools, which ones are more, highly vaccinated versus those that are not. And so we have, we've dropped there. And I'm sure that's the work that we need to do, is we really need to help families understand more about vaccines and be able to present it to them in a great way.
And I want to dive down in that a little bit, but just for our listeners who aren't familiar with the term exemption rate, is that something that a school-age parent, the parent of a school-age child, do they have to file something if their child is not vaccinated with MMR? Is that what that tells us?
Yeah, there is a tutorial that parents can go on. They take a quick class on immunizations, and then they sign that they do not want their child to be vaccinated for either all vaccines or for those that they don't want them to be vaccinated for. And that becomes their exemption. And so that's their record.
And when you mentioned that you want to try to engage in education, what would you say to a parent who might be listening and says, you know what, I'm just kind of reluctant to let my child have that MMR shot? What would you say to them?
One of the best tools that we have as providers is to really, really listen to our families and to our parents, and to understand where they're coming from, and, you know, acknowledge that they do have fears around vaccines. And then hopefully the goal really is to build that trust, to learn about their family, to learn about their fears, and then ask them if they would allow us to do some education with them. I think it's a hard subject for those families who really reject vaccines. But there are those that are open who haven't made that a strong decision, that we can have great conversations around vaccines.
What are the kinds of objections you hear, and what does the science tell us about the safety and efficacy of the MMR vaccine?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really interesting. I went to a conference yesterday, and we did get to see what parents are thinking and feeling based off survey around vaccines. And number one was fear. Number two is that they don't think it's necessary, right? And then it just blended down into a lot of different things that really didn't feel that as relevant to me. But yeah, I think parents just have fears. And I think that the education sometimes helps. And, you know, if you're open to learning, yeah.
And what does the science tell us about the both the dangers of the vaccine on the one hand and the dangers of the disease on the other?
Well, so the vaccine, go ahead, Lana, I'm going to let you get.
Sorry, I should have called on you. Go ahead, Lana. You're not a potted plant. We appreciate you being here.
So something that the science is showing us is this is a vaccine that's been around for a long time, and it's about a 97% effective rate for those that are willing, right, to get that vaccine. And most people here in Wasatch County are getting the vaccine. We have about 88% rate of our students. And as far as the problems and the harms is that we're seeing hospitalization rates of children about, right, we got 1 to 5. So kids that are being hospitalized, and it's because of the effects and how contagious this disease can be, especially to our population that's younger than 5 years old.
Okay, so what you're saying is that for children under 5 who contract measles, there is a substantial risk of hospitalization, and I understand there's even been 1 or 2 deaths. Am I right about that?
Yes,
okay.
True.
Okay. Now, if I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, you know what, I'd like to learn a little bit more about the vaccine, and I'm thinking about getting my 5-year-old vaccinated, is it too late? And how could I learn more from you guys about that vaccine?
You're just welcome to call us. We'll talk to you directly on the phone, or you can make an appointment, come in and meet with us. So we're always open and available to help families and to learn more about vaccines.
And again, there's no reason that if I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, you know, maybe I want to rethink my decision to get the vaccine. My kid's 7 years old. There's no reason I couldn't come in and do that at this point, is there?
None at all. They're welcome to come in, and there's no wrong time to come in for that.
Okay. So. Anything else you guys want to touch on with respect to measles and the vaccine before we move on?
I just think the good news is we have a very pretty highly immunized population. I really feel like if we do get the measles here, it'll hit a certain population, but it'll die off because of the high vaccination rates. I'm feeling positive vibes, hopefully, on this.
Okay, and again,
who
do they reach out to if they want more information? What's the phone number to call?
Wasatch County Health Department. Our number is 435
657-3307. We also have vaccines for adults who do not have insurance at a very low cost of $12.
Okay. And with that, I'd like to pivot on to the drug take-back event. What, Lana, tell me what that is.
Yeah, so the drug take-back event is an opportunity for families to come and drop off prescription medications or opioids that they've received that are outdated or unneeded in their home. And they can bring those over to Smith's Marketplace down in Heber City. It's going to be, if you're driving, you're about to park, it's on the right-hand side of the building. There'll be an area for you to bring any old prescription medications that you might have.
Okay. And when is this event? This is tomorrow?
This will be tomorrow from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. And this is just one opportunity. So, right, the whole reason we even invite families to come and do this is because these old prescriptions and medications can be harmful. It can be harmful if they're used improperly or totally unintentionally by a little child. Mm. And they also just, if we want to make sure that we're properly disposing our medications, because if we were to just put them in the sink or put them in the trash can, that can cause impact to our water ecosystem. It can also impact, just like in general, can harm our children if they were to get a hold of their hands on those. And so we would just recommend that if you don't have time to go tomorrow to Smith's Marketplace, take them to one of the permanent drop-off locations. We've got three in Wasatch County. We've got one at the Wasatch County Sheriff's Office, one at the police station, and then one at Lee's Marketplace.
I'm sorry, the third one is Lee's Marketplace.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And so, again, if I flush them down the toilet or I put them in the landfill, both of those can have sort of undesirable environmental effects. So I take it that when they go to one of these disposal sites, there is a process to dispose of them that is not environmentally harmful.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Anything else you want to add on that before we go?
No, I think that's everything. We're just excited to continue making a difference in our homes one step at a time.
Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
You bet. Thank you.
Well, joining me in the studio this morning after what apparently was quite a long meeting last night, we have Park City Council Member Tana Tolley. Good morning, Tana.
Good morning, Roger. I'm glad to be here with you this morning.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So, you received a staff report on housing goals and priorities. It looked to me like a couple things were going on. The recommendation that the target AMI is going down and the number of target units is going up. How are you going to get there?
That's a good question. Well, I'll take us back a little bit. Yeah. So during our council retreat, we had a discussion about how we would like to move forward in what is formally known or is known around the U.S. as AMI. And we decided that instead of using this AMI term, we were going to use what's called workforce wages. And that is because there is such a disparity between our AMI and our workforce wages. So we just learned that the AMI for Park City is about $165,000. Since I've been on council, it's gone up about $30,000 every since 2022. And we realized that the workforce wage is not keeping up with what the AMI is. So that just means there's more people moving here who may not be working actually in Park City, which we know because there's only about 12% of our population that works in Park City.
So that's really interesting. I'm visualizing statistics and the differences between averages and medians. So normally a median does sort of capture what's going on. But in this instance, what you're saying is, because our population is largely making its money somewhere else,
yes,
the median doesn't really capture realistically what it would take to service the workforce.
Correct. And also, one of the things we did learn at our retreat, too, was that our demographic of age demographic has gone up quite a bit as well. And so we've gone from about, I think it was 38 years old 10 years ago to over 60. And so the amount of money, the difference in just the age, like people's the population has increased as well. So.
Wait. Are you saying that the median age in Park City is 60 years old?
I think it's a little higher than 60. I can't remember the exact one it was, but
it has
grown.
Old. I guess I fit that demographic.
I feel very young. Now.
You are very young. Okay, so that's really interesting. Again, we have a target. I guess the hard part is how do you try to, what tools is the city thinking of to try to meet those goals, which are pretty high in terms of the number of workforce units that you're looking to have in place in, what is it, 10 years?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of tools that we can use. And so one that we used at the Engine House is a public-private partnership where the city gives up the land and then a private developer comes in and builds the units, and those became rental units. The council has also looked at, do we want to continue to build some for sale units? Do we want to have some just rental units? And the pendulum had swung from being for sale about 10 years ago, and that was the big focus of the council then, to then about 2 or 3 years ago, we went to a high rental idea, and now I think we're coming back with, like, I think we're going to need both, right? And we want to ensure that the workforce is taken care of. So people understand, the workforce wage is, when we say 100% workforce wage, that is about 60% of the AMI. And so with that, we are going to be trying to house everyone from people who work at the ski resorts to our teachers to the firefighters, and anyone in between. And so the ranges of workforce wages are going to going to be on a pendulum swing from there as well. So we are looking at everything that you can possibly look at. We need senior housing, we know that. We need attainable housing, we need affordable housing, and just like a dartboard that you'd throw a dart at, you're not gonna miss a target in this community. We need it all.
This would segue into a much longer and detailed discussion about the relative economics of rental versus ownership. And I assume that's something you guys are doing internally as well. It's a very complicated question.
It is, and we also have to take into account HOA fees and HOA dues. And when we do deed restrictions on some of these homes, they only increase about 3% every year. And so you're not getting a huge equity into your home. And so if you need a new roof in 20 years, you'll have to be budgeting for that. You can't just take out an equity line like I could by owning a home. So there's a lot of factors that we are looking at. But I will say this, Park City is ahead of the rest of the state in many regards. I serve on the board of the Leagues of Cities and Towns, and I was just in St. George this past week and had many conversations with city councilors and mayors of other towns that say, what did you do right? What would you do differently? And I think it's been a good testament to Park City trying different things and seeing what works and what doesn't. And then for the next 10 years, we're just going to have to get creative and focused. And we know, technology is moving so fast. AI is like crazy at how quickly AI is moving. So how do we move forward in a way that is foreseeing what's going to happen in the next 10 years?
So a few weeks ago, I thought the discussion about ranked choice voting was over, and it was coming on this year, but plot twist last night. What happened?
Yes, so I do want to disclose that I am running for city council. So
I think you got to announce that on this broadcast
a
few weeks ago. But yes, you're running
but
for city council.
Just in case someone wasn't
Please.
Listening, okay. Even though we know the whole community listens every morning to
Absolutely.
You, Roger. One of our councilors, Councilor Sirocco, during his council comments, said that he believes he's made a mistake in voting for ranked choice voting, which we decided about a month ago. And so let me just back up a little bit. So when we did decide that, we did know that we had until May 1st to tell the lieutenant governor that this was the type of voting system that we would use this year. And at that time, I believe it sent a message to the community that if you were wanting to run for council or mayor, you would now have until August to file. So now, if on Monday, which it does sound like on Monday, we're going to have a special meeting now, it does sound like three of our council members are in favor of overturning this. And if that sticks on Monday, then we will go back to the traditional way of voting. And that means the deadline is now at the beginning of June. So that just gives us about 4 weeks for people to decide whether or not they would like to run for council or mayor. I was very surprised and very shocked, to say the least. And understanding that everyone is allowed to make changes, and as Bill stated last night, he wanted to state that he believes he made the wrong decision, and Jeremy and Ed were in favor of moving forward with this special meeting, which will happen Monday at 4 to decide if we will overturn this.
Was there any probably should ask Bill, but was there any sort of quick version of the explanation as to what the change in heart was based on, what the analytics were?
Well, I do know that there was some information sent to us by the Utah County clerk, and that might be part of the reason for his reasoning. I will say I looked into that as well, and there's actually quite a few stories if you go to the Tribune or KSL talking about what happened in Utah County, and he's actually being investigated as well. And so there's, in anything we do, there's always two sides to every story. So for coming from Tana as the counselor, I didn't find there any reason for us to overturn the vote that we had in March. However, Bill and Jeremy and Ed may have felt differently, and Ryan was not in attendance last night.
And this, and I know Ryan is a big proponent of ranked choice voting.
Yes, yes.
This will get picked up at the Monday meeting, and we'll certainly cover it. Let's see. What else did I want? There was a discussion. The gondola came back up again, didn't it?
Kind of. So we did have a staff communications that was talking about how we are going out for an RSOQ, which is a request for qualifications. And that is about Sweet Alley and Main Street and changing if we're going to go pedestrian or one way or just really the feasibility of that. We also had talked about at one point doing these, forgetting the term right now, sorry, but the geothermal underground.
Yes.
And seeing if that's going to be feasible. They do that in Vail and some of the other ski cities. But that was part of it. There was also a part of our staff report included a synopsis of the four times that we have discussed gondolas over the course of, gosh, I want to say 10 years. And so there's, so if the public is interested, you can go in there and see that. But we will, on May 24th, actually have a full in-depth conversation about the feasibility of gondolas, not just from the Brewpub lot, but from anywhere in this Old Town corridor.
Okay, real quickly, budget came up. I understand one of the issues is about the contribution to the 248 park and ride. What's the issue and where do you come down on it?
So with that, the city manager's budget had $10 million going to be earmarked for a park and ride. And we don't have a location specific. We just know that it would be in the 248 corridor. And that is coming from, $5 million was coming from our general fund and $5 million was coming from our transportation fund. And the majority of council felt that we weren't far enough along to have that money earmarked for it. So we are not, we're going to keep $5 million in the general fund and we're going to keep the $5 million in the transportation fund with the acknowledgement that at any time our transportation team could come back and say we're ready to move forward with a project and we can pull that funding. So it doesn't say like we're not going forward with this, it's just a reallocation of the funds.
And we could have an entire conversation about that 248 park and ride and the importance of it, but we don't quite have enough time.
Correct.
You mentioned that you have announced your run for city council. Earlier this week, Ryan Dickey announced his run for mayor. I take it you're not going to run against him?
No, and I actually support Ryan. So I think I've enjoyed being on council. I think I've done a great job, and there's a lot more to do. So I have said I will run for council, and I will support Ryan for running for mayor.
Are you expecting any other entrants into the mayoral race?
Roger, as of yesterday, I felt that we had quite a bit of time before people would have to announce. So not anymore. So I'm not sure. And to be quite honest with you, I don't know.
Okay. Tana, we have just about run out of time, but the issue we didn't get to was the Bonanza, the BOPA
yes.
code amendment. Is that on hold for now? Or
no, it will go back to Planning Commission, I want to say on the 14th,
okay.
And then it's going to come back. We did give direction, though, that we want to get this right, and we don't want to just make some quick decisions, because there was a lot more information brought forward last night at a legislative level that council reviewed. So this is far from finished, and we want to just keep moving forward with it. But we have sent it back to Planning Commission to have them look at a few of the details, and then it's going to come back to council, and we're going to do a work session on it as well.
Okay. Tana Tolley, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks, Roger. Have a great day.
We'll be right back after this.
The Summit County GOP elected new leadership this week. Joining us by phone is newly elected Chairman Ari Iannides. KPCW board member Pat O'Connell is the secretary of the Summit County Republican Party. He has had no input into the content of this interview. Also, we're going to provide equal time by interviewing Democratic Party Chair Rory Swenson next week. Ari, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure, Roger.
Ari, in the press release, you indicated that you want to restore conservative strength and unity across the county. Can you explain a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think in the past, some conservative factions have been fighting within our own party. And, what comes to mind is the Phil Lyman incident, I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people started taking sides and fighting against each other internally. And I think what leadership has come to realize is that, you know, one of the things we need to do is to stay together, stay cohesive, build a big tent, and stop fighting amongst ourselves if we ever expect to win in Summit County.
Okay. And so, again, a party like the Republican Party, Democratic Party, any political party has to have core values. And I think you said something else in the press release that referenced core values. What do you believe the core values that are shared by those who identified as Republicans? You know, in other words, if you're going to build a big tent, it's got to have some polls. So I assume those polls are core values. Share a little bit about your perspective on what those core values are.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up because, you know, when I think back on all the factions of the Republican Party's had over the past few years, there's a couple things that have stayed constant that I think would benefit everyone in the county. And, you know, one of the big ones I'm thinking of right now is fiscal responsibility. You know, smaller government, allowing people to keep more of their money and to reduce the impact that government has on people. Now, Republicans believe strongly that core services need to be provided and that those should be provided by a government. The government should be properly funded for those core services. But, you know, we also need to make sure that the people who are in charge are take responsibility for properly spending that money and you know, making sure that they have the lightest footprint possible. So that's one of those big core values. The other one is supporting families, you know, and our children, and allowing folks to be able to raise their children within their own value system and support, and, you know, have freedom to do so. So freedom over your property rights. These are all big core values. And regardless of whether you're a Reagan Republican or a, you know, Christian conservative or part of the Tea Party, or a MAGA Republican, those core values are pretty consistent across the board.
And when you think about applying some of those principles to governance here in Summit County, what are some of the ways in which you think that a Republican voice could sort of add balance or add robustness to sort of exemplifying those values within the Summit County government?
I think that anybody who looks at their property tax or their total tax bill here in Summit County would appreciate someone who looks at spending and looks to reduce that footprint would appreciate, you know, that kind of input. One of the big things I see, and rightly so, is, you know, the tax burden that we're paying in the budget for the county especially has outpaced the rate of inflation 2-1. In certain departments, and I get it, having worked in government, departments want to grow. They want to be bigger. They want to have a bigger impact. But it's up to our elected leaders to push back on some of that and make sure it's accountable. And I'm not saying that it's not happening at all, but I'm saying the results are there. And everyone I talk to across the political spectrum, no matter what their income, if they own property in Summit County, right now they're having a problem with the amount of taxes. Now, I understand 60% of that is taken up by the various schools, but we need to look at that too. Now, I know that school boards are nonpartisan, but, you know, when I look over the past, you know, 7 years at Park City School District, you know, we've gone from spending $10,000 a student to, I believe, as much as $15,000. We have a decreasing population, but we keep having tax increases. So it's really not just Summit County. It also includes all three of our school districts that are within our county, too. I think, once again, a little bit of responsibility. Yes.
Of course, that's okay. That's one good example, but it's tricky to implement. What kinds of initiatives do you want to see the party as a party here in Summit County do to try to sort of invigorate it?
Well, I think a couple of things we need to do are really, you know, people who feel like maybe the Republican Party has drifted away from their values and has lost their way. One of the things we need to do is work hard to articulate, you know, the type of governance we would like to see. And you know, one of the things I'm trying to do is articulate that publicly. And I'll give you an example. I'll give you a really great example. Let's take the Yarrow, for example. There's a great plan sitting there right now to redevelop the Yarrow, which gives us or gives the community a lot of community benefits and trails, a much better looking building, affordable housing, you know, all things that would really benefit the community. This is the second or third time they've tried to redevelop that project. And when speaking to the developer, they're spending millions of dollars just to go through red tape. And I know I'm oversimplifying this, but we're breaking it down to 10 feet, right? Mm-hmm. And in just about any other community, it works like this. And I know this because I develop property in California. It's an administrative process. If you have a certain amount of, if it's mixed use, you get a bit higher density, better parking. If you're near transit, you don't have to provide as many spaces. If you have a certain percentage of affordable housing, you get another 10 feet. And that kind of administrative process saves money because developers know what the community wants, know what the rules are, and it makes it easy to get those processes through. Right now, it's really hard. It's driving up our housing costs, and it's making us hard to get the community benefit we really need. So I think having people who understand that and folks who really can articulate that within our community, candidates who can do that, a party that can do that, makes sense.
Okay, so we've got a couple of good issues here. We've talked about fiscal responsibility. We've talked about reducing red tape. Have you got a third on the top of your head?
You know, yes, I think that right now there's a feeling in many parts of the county where government's not responsive mm-hmm. at the local level, where some of our leaders feel like they know more or they're the smartest people in the room. And they may, because, you know, our staff from the city, the county, and the school districts do a really good job of informing council. But you know, in many cases, I know recently this past Wednesday, I went to a county council meeting that was billed as a public input session, where public input was ultimately limited to just, people who had never commented on it before. And, you know, there was maybe a chance for people who had commented before to comment, but that was shut down. And then we were given basically a lesson on how the reason why they're doing things. And that echoed to me similar, you know, to what happened for Dakota Pacific. We would go to these meetings, we'd give feedback. And then instead of the feedback being listened to and echoed back, we would basically get a lecture on why this was good for the community. And I think having a multi-party system where people listen and are better connected to their, voters, I think would maybe cut through some of that.
Well, and that sort of takes us to a natural segue into HB 356. You know, before we get to the substance of that, one of the things that I think people have complained about is in the past, the Utah legislature sort of rams bills through at the last minute. What do you say to those who complain that this was pushed through at the last minute without allowing some county to really weigh in on it?
Yeah, I can hear that. And that's, you know, it's they're not wrong because it was, you know, ultimately got the final passage. But that was three votes in, Roger. You know, the first vote happened on this back in February when it passed the House.
Right.
Before it went through the House, I actually sat in on a public meeting where public input was taken in. I do know that some Summit County officials were at that meeting via Zoom. They actually tried to comment, but for some reason, and I think it was an honest mistake, the meeting was similar to what happened this past Wednesday. You know, they closed public session when somebody else wanted to talk. As a matter of fact, Wednesday when somebody asked the chair, you know, hey, we've got more people who want to talk. One of the other council people stepped in and went, well, public comment session is closed. So it's hard to imagine that, you know, council would argue that they didn't have a chance to have public comment. It is true, though, that when it did go to committee on the Senate, that it was circled. I know that county council is using the term pulled. I don't know that it was ever officially pulled. You can go look at the record, but it was circled within the committee. That means it could come back up, and public comment was not accepted. So, you know, they're not wrong in that way. But their lobbyists, and I know they changed the lobbyists halfway through the process, did have an opportunity to have their voices heard. I know that a couple of the council people did go down and speak to the sponsor of the bill in the House, and they were able to successfully make some changes. So I think the contention that it was passed at the last minute without knowledge of the council is tough.
Well, the last minute is certainly true, but I hear what you're saying. And, you know, I think that the argument I've heard, as you've just expressed it, is that the county believed that it was off the table. Whether that was accurate or not, go ahead.
I'm going to say that, you know, the county, you know, maybe a couple of people from the other party on county council would help them be better plugged into to what's going on. And I do know that, you know, and I heard from a good source that halfway through that process, they did get a different lobbying group working for them. And I know that we can't expect our county councilors to know everything that's going on behind the scenes, especially when it's run by the opposite party. But they are paying professionals to keep track of this stuff. They do get updates at every single meeting. And I think, you know, it's unfortunate that they weren't quite as informed as they could have been. I wasn't really clued in on what was happening until it did pass the House.
Okay.
And I did like that particular version, by the way, the much better that came
now
at that point.
There was a piece in the Park Record. What are some of the principal reasons that you and other leaders like Tory Welch believe that this change in the way the county council is structured, the way the people vote on it, why do you believe that's appropriate?
You know, my reasons are probably different than Tory's. When I went out and campaigned on the east side, my goal for entering the campaign initially as a candidate was to represent those who were unrepresented. You know, basically folks from the rural part of the county who felt like they didn't have a voice on council that reflected their values. And I know that when I first moved here, you know, I had a council person from my party who lived in my area, who kind of knew and even though he didn't live near me, because I lived, you know, closer in the Park City, I could call him and talk to David and say, hey, look, here are my concerns. And I thought, David, you did a great job. What I realized really quickly talking to people on the east side is, you know, I'm a former tech entrepreneur. Now, I am a large landowner. I have very little in common with these people beyond the fact that I, you know, proximity and geography and party. And what's happened is, you know, the hubris I had to believe that I could represent those people, my fellow Republicans and people who live in my area, is just beyond the pale. And I think that's what a lot of our leaders, where they are, you know. And yeah, they are representing them, but all of the votes that get them in come from Park City, Snyderville Basin. You can win 75% of the east side, and you have to get almost 47% of the Park City, Snyderville Basin in order to be elected. So if I know, and I actually had somebody tell me this during my race, why are you wasting time on the east side? Those people won't get you elected. You have to focus on Park City and Snyderville Basin. It's true. So if that's where my political power comes from, why should I listen to anyone else? And my contention is that every at-large seat on council is a de facto Park City, Snyderville Basin seat. And that's why I think some people are fighting now for 5 seats. That way we have equal representation.
I'm sorry, the last part. Some people are fighting now for 5 seats.
Yeah. Well, that's what the legislation calls for.
Right.
For five districts.
Okay. That's right. Okay. So again, so I guess the principle is that allowing, mandating those districts would sort of allow for a more representative government, because those who are in the minority on the east side are not really being allowed to express themselves and are not really being heard. Have I got that basically right?
Yeah, and they feel that way. I mean, it's a unanimous feeling among people who live on that side of the county. And I want to say one more thing. I grew up in the South, and during segregation, And we would hear things on the radio from people like Lester Maddox, where I understand the needs of our, I can't quote him exactly because of the language if he used, but
please don't.
I understand the needs of our Black neighbors, and they don't want to be integrated into community. They like being separate, and they like their children being, and we, you know, if we give them political power, they, you know, in essence, they're not smart enough to hold those seats. And, you know, what I hear coming out of council and some people who are fighting this is eerily similar echo, you know, to that. It's geographic and political apartheid. And I know those are tough words, but that's how people feel. And for, and there were a couple people who spoke Wednesday who recognized that and said, I don't know how people on the east side feel. And that's right, they don't. That's why they need a seat at the table.
Well, all right. I mean, here's the tough question. Given those principles, would you and the Summit County Republican Party be in favor of the or in support of the Independent Redistricting Commission as passed by the voters in 2018 that would draw federal and state legislative districts in a way that would give voice to people who are essentially gerrymandered out?
You know, I will say this. The bill as it sits right now has a bipartisan, and I mean that, bipartisan districting commission
right. That
I assume the county would appoint someone from the Sangerville Basin. It has, you know, our clerk, who is a Democrat, also would be there. Nan Worrell would be a part of that. And you also have, you know, a mayor, I believe Zane is a Democrat as well. So to say that this is a commission that's bent on gerrymandering this process, I think that is hollow. What it sounds like to me is that the county wants to have a hand at the county commission based on, you know, hey, whatever we hear, we may want to override it, or we want a public input, or we want to appoint some of the people on that commission, or we want three seats on that commission. All these things to me are, you're drawing your own boundaries, and that doesn't sound right.
So, I think you misunderstood my question. What I'm asking you about is, given those principles, and I think you've articulated them very well, when the voters in the state of Utah in 2018 passed the Independent Redistricting Commission with respect to congressional districts and state legislative districts, they wanted, you know, a bipartisan independent district to redraw the maps, and the legislature rejected it. What I'm asking is, from your perspective, don't those same principles mean that you would be in support of the Independent Redistricting Commission at the state level?
I told you
it was a tough question.
No, it's not tough. For me, independently, I supported that independent districting commission. I thought, I felt that it was overreach for the legislature at that time to set it aside. I mean, the will of the people is strong, you know, and they made their voices clear, and they overrode what happened in the legislature. And I know there are people in my party who disagree with that.
Yep.
But I spoke with people on Better Boundaries specifically about those issues. That's a hard thing to go against your party. I get that because very few people do that and they get upset about it. And they, you know, sometimes they're not your friend anymore because of it. Yeah. But our party's not like that anymore. That's not how we're going to run things in Summit County. And whether, you know, there's no litmus test. If you're against us on one particular issue, that's because you have a reason for it. We're going to accept you.
Last question, Ari. Going to run for office again?
Yes. No.
Okay.
I will not run for public office in Summit County ever again. And people were mad when this bill passed and, you know, I took a stance on it and they were, you know, you will never hold office. Well, you're right. I won't because I'm not going to run. I've given up the domain. My email doesn't work. I have made a commitment to supporting other people in our party who want to run. And it was a little, you know, that's our job, right? So if I'm going to hold this job as chair of Summit County GOP party, my job is to hold other people up and make sure they have the tools to get elected.
Thanks for spending time with us this morning, Ari.
It's always a pleasure talking to you, Roger. Have a great day.
We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Local News Hour. Once again, that last interview with Ari Ioannidis, who is the newly elected GOP chair for Summit County. We'll be running another interview next week with the Democratic chair for Summit County, Rory Swenson, as we maintain balance here at KPCW. Coming up, we'll have the community campfire. We got this week, they're going to visit with Matt Linden. He's a Summit County original who's called this place home since the 70s and helped build Deer Valley from the ground up. Then you're going to learn about Ken McCarthy. He almost single-handedly built a popular trail network in the Heber Valley while empowering others along the way. The campfire music sesh will introduce Salt Lake City artist Spencer Paul. And don't forget the hilarious Campfire Kids, Friday Fun Facts, and Coach Skinner's Sports. I wonder what Coach Skinner's going to come up with this time of year. Community Campfire will be coming up here on KPCW right after this broadcast. Also, Monday on Mountain Money, we're going to have a really interesting show. We're going to start with author Brian Goldstone. His book is called There's No Place for Us. It's really about the struggles of the working poor, people who work full-time and are still having to remain homeless. Really interesting interview coming up.